The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This morning I'm going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is suffering. It's where it all happens, isn't it? We're all familiar with the truths that are stated in the Four Noble Truths. And we're going to be talking about the front end of those truths today. We know, because we've been taught and because we experience it, that there is suffering and that there's a cause for suffering. The easy way to just sort of boil it down is wanting something to be different than it is. Wanting something different, wanting something better, wanting someone else, wanting to be somewhere else, something else. Dissatisfaction with what is. And then some people say, well, what about loss of loved ones, serious illness, the death of a child, all of those things? Those are not the suffering. The suffering is what we add. They're part of human existence. They're simply there. And as long as we're in the position of adding that little extra something, there's going to be suffering. And that's going to be the little place within the Four Noble Truths that I'd like to focus this morning. What happens? What is that little extra something that happens? There's a cessation of suffering. And not too long ago, maybe just a few weeks ago, I was reading a book. I don't remember what it was, but you know how someone can say something and it just sort of springs something loose in your mind? And I thought, oh my God, suffering is optional. Always. So the question we're going to talk about today is, what is that option that we pick up so readily? For some reason, over and over and over again, we choose suffering. No one does that part of it to us. No one gives us that choice. No one makes us be unsatisfied or resentful or hateful or any of those things. We choose that every single time. The problem usually is before we notice we've chosen it, we're a long way down that path. It's something we add to what's happening. And when I was thinking about this, I was reminded of the way of Suzuki Roshi's one of his favorite phrases. He would talk about things as it is. And he knew that grammatically correct was things as they are. But he called it things as it is. And so there's things that it is, and then there's something that we pour into the bowl. What do we pour in there? We add me. Right? And the more we add me to things that are causing us dissatisfaction, the bigger me gets. I read something just this last week. It was a phrase that I thought was so beautiful. To have a mind that just meets each thing without deciding if it is worthy or not. Things as it is. Instead, we say, do I like it? Do I want it? Maybe it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't happen to me. I was in the loft this morning and, you know, reading over the invocation we just sang, and something grabbed me also. Did you notice these words? Life and death are simply places where the Buddha nature resides. When we bow to true conditions, nothing hinders, nothing hides. Seeing clearly ends our suffering. So perhaps the end of suffering lies right in the middle of the thing that we try to run away from. Just the process of letting it be what it is, maybe, is the key. We tend to put a value on things that we bump into, whether they're good. Are they good things? Are they bad things? Or am I just indifferent? And it's such a low level and so constant, we no longer even notice we do it. You know, what happens, you know, those of you who don't live here visit here and you've been at meals, and what happens when the food appears? Your mind is going, you know. Where's the sugar? I like ketchup. And what that means is that we go through life meeting everything as an object as it relates to me. It isn't just as it is. We sort of almost glom it onto ourselves. The gravitational center of the universe for, you know, for what is, yeah. So, as we go through here, I have a couple of exercises which you can try for yourself. You know, sometimes I've heard it described that being in the human body is being in a very, very sensitive condition. Things irritate us. We're very delicate. Our minds and our bodies. And that irritation quite often is what gets us going down that path to choosing a little suffering to toss in. So here's what you can do. Tomorrow when you get up, try to notice every time your mind goes good, bad, no, yes. Try to notice it, because we're doing it all the time. And even the huge amounts of suffering that we may experience at times all start with that little thing. So it's just a matter of noticing what it is that kind of sets you down that path. I've told this story probably a million times before, but I was out at the Hermitage one time. And it was lovely, you know, it was nice weather, I was enjoying what I was cooking, everything was perfect, and the phone rang and somebody from the Abbey called me. And in the course of the conversation, they mentioned that there was this opportunity which I was hoping I would be able to do, that someone else was being offered it. I was in a hell, I hung up the phone, and I was in a hell realm. I'd been in heaven, you know. Sound over the telephone was all it was. There wasn't even a person in front of me. And suddenly, I was just plunged into complete depression. But because I was all alone out there and there weren't a whole lot of distractions, I thought, my God, would you look at that? Would you look at that? So simple. A few words out of somebody else's mouth, and it's changed my whole day, and they aren't even there. So I remember that often, and I hope I don't tell this again 6 months from now. Things that can be irritating that are kind of interesting. I mean, you can walk down the street and you can say to yourself, she shouldn't have chosen that blouse. Or, my God, he's rude. Or, what else do I have? You hear someone addressing someone else in extremely coarse speech. All of these things ping. And we're getting, right in those little things, we're getting kind of these little pricks that can start us down the path. I have a family member who carries on a loud conversation with many other people who are sharing the freeway with her. You know, it's... And how calming is that? I hate smoke, don't you? You know, we have a lot of opportunities right now. Politics. You either love it or you hate it. Your computer. All of these things, little things that happen to us all during the day that are just kind of lightly ruffling our edges. I was contemplating the question as part of this exercise, can I feel grumpy without being grumpy or acting grumpy, or you know, can grumpy be a neutral state of mind? I'm working on that one. Another thing is uncertainty, which is how we experience the law of impermanence. Right now, as you know, there's a forest fire in the Marble Wilderness. And as many of you know, one of our hermitages is out in Scott Valley. And right now, there are monks out there trying to prepare the house to be possibly withstand fire, because the fire is getting closer. And they still haven't been able to bring this fire under control. We've done this before. And what do? You go out there and you do what you can do. So they're out there and they're, you know, nailing boards on and trying to prevent places for sparks to take hold and making the property generally defensible. The wind could shift a half hour from now and send it in some completely other direction, or it could shift and just shove the fire straight down. It's uncertain. It's always uncertain. It's just that not most of the things we encounter aren't quite as dramatic as that. Does that have to be suffering? They're out there doing what they need to do. That's all they can do. It is what it's going to be. Now, in our daily life, a lot of times we try to prevent ourselves from the suffering from uncertainty, because we think somehow we can, and so we try to take control of things. Where are we? You know, we think if we get more data, if we make plans, if we schedule things, if we make lists, if we make rules, so that people won't do things that we think are wrong. All of those things, we try to control the suffering that we can experience from uncertainty. But of course, you know, you can only go so far with that, because uncertainty is uncertainty even if you're ready for it. Uncertainty is things as it is all the time. Anybody worry here? No worriers? This is a place that's just ripe with opportunities to suffer. And we try to control that. You know, have you ever felt like you're looking around and there's so much to do? You know, not only that you aren't going to be able to get it done, but because there's all of these things, you keep getting distracted. You know, you start doing one thing and you go, oh my God, and you run over here, and then, oh my God, and you run over to the other place. So you say to yourself, I know what I'll do. I'll take control of this. I'll make a list. So you sit down and you make a list. Then you look at it and you think, oh, it's even longer than I thought it was going to be. So you say, well, I'll just start doing what's on the list. So you start working your way down. And have you ever had the experience that you think it's going to take you a week and you finish before lunch? You know? So then you say, I'm sure I forgot something. I must have forgotten something. Worry is a tough one because we all have a strong desire to be responsible. And somehow, if someone isn't worrying, or if you're not worrying, or if I'm not worrying, we can think we aren't being responsible. Doesn't have to be like that. Doesn't have to make that connection. Worry is a beautiful example of one of those extras that we tack on to things. So now let's talk about recreational suffering. It always happens to me. They're always doing it to me. Drama queen. Soap opera. Recreational victim. Habitual victim. And when I got to this part, I sort of cringed because I realized that when you choose this kind of suffering for yourself, what it really can do is try to hide something that you actually need to look at. And I cringed because almost since I got to the monastery almost 20 years ago, my teachers have been saying, you know, you complain. I said, no, I'm not complaining. I'm just sort of stating how things are. You're complaining. This is my my master would say, he'd just turn to me and say, you're doing it again. You're doing it again. To this day, I still haven't got a handle on that, but I can't ever forget that that is my habitual, I don't know if you would include that in recreational suffering, but my way of dealing with things that are disturbing to me is to put it in that form. You know, it's sort of like when you say that famous phrase, you know, you hear someone say, you know that person? You know, she's such a lovely person. I really like her. But there it comes. Anybody do that? Yeah. I was reading yesterday, John Semedo has a book that's called The Mind and the Way. It's one of my favorites, and I keep coming back to it. So because I was going to be talking about aspects of the Four Noble Truths, I thought I'd look in to see what he had to say. And he stressed something which I had forgotten about, a way of looking at suffering. Like anything else, it arises, it abides, and it passes away. And so rather than having to deal with suffering while it's abiding, when you're really uncomfortable, start trying to train your mind to notice the arising. That's what I was talking about earlier, when you just get up in the morning and try to see if you can find the things that kind of ping you all during the day. I started making a list one day, and it was amazing how much you can do in just a few short hours. You know, I didn't write them down. I just went tick, you know, made a little tally. What he was saying was that we miss an opportunity every time we let it get out of control. He put it as an opportunity. He wasn't saying suffering is optional, but he was certainly implying that that could be the case. Imagine you're on the freeway, like my friend, and a car cuts in front of you. You know, you can scream at them, or, you know, you can scream at them in your mind, or you can say, that was unwise, period, and go on to the next thing. You know, we're always going to be noticing the things that are arising and happening around us, but it's that ping that we need to look out for. And we all, you know, we talk about knowing people who are able to push all our buttons. We all have all of those buttons, and those are the ones that we have to become very well acquainted with, because every time someone brushes up against one of them, there's the chance of going off down the road of suffering. Now, the glory of this is if you can get yourself to stop cursing at people who drive in front of you immediately, or becoming really angry at people who upset you or situations. If you can catch these things in the beginning, you no longer have to go through those really awful, painful, emotional roller coaster rides that we go on. I know that maybe some people in the world would think that that's not a very exciting way to live, that it must be kind of dull. But lack of suffering is certainly not and what you would call a dull place to live. It's a rich, it's a very rich and open place to live. You can be truly yourself and truly with everything around you. What it boils down to is just the thing we keep hearing over and over and over again. There's only one place to take refuge, and that's right here and right now. And now, I brought a story. This is a John Brahms rendering of an old story, which you've probably heard before in one form or another, but I really like this. A good nun lived a very simple life, with few possessions and dwelling in a cave. Every morning she would take her alms bowl to the nearby village to collect just enough food for her one meal of the day. She had plenty of time to meditate, study, and teach what she knew to any of the local villagers. When she returned from alms round one morning, she noticed a hole in her spare robe, so she found a small piece of cloth and hand-sewed a patch onto the robe. She'd done this before. You see, in her cave lived a family of mice, and they liked nibbling her robes. While sewing, she thought that if she had a cat, then there would be no mice, and she wouldn't have to spend so much time sewing patches. So the next day she asked the villagers for a cat, and they gave her a well-behaved brown cat whose color matched her robes. The cat needed milk and fish, so the nun had to ask the villagers for these extra items every morning. One morning she thought that if she had her own cow, then she wouldn't need to keep asking for milk to feed the cat to keep the mice that chewed her robes. So she asked one of her wealthy supporters for a cow. Once the nun had a cow, she had to get grass for the cow to eat. So she begged the villagers for grass to feed her cow, to provide milk for the cat to keep away the mice that chewed her robes. After a few days, the nun thought that if she had her own field, then she wouldn't need to harass the poor villagers for grass every day. So she arranged for a collection to be made to buy a nearby pasture, to provide grass for her cow, to provide milk for the cat, to keep away the mice that chewed her robes. It was a lot of work looking after the pasture, catching the cow every morning and milking it. So she thought that it would be helpful to have a boy, a young attendant, who could do all these chores for her. In return, the nun would give him moral guidance and teachings. The villagers selected a boy from a poor family in dire need of some moral guidance. Now she had a boy to look after the pasture, to provide grass for her cow, to provide milk for the cat, to keep away the mice that chewed her robes. Now the nun needed to collect more than twice as much food every morning, because young boys eat a lot. Moreover, she needed a small hut nearby for the boy to sleep in, because it was against the rules for the boy to sleep in the cave with a nun. So she asked the villagers to build a hut for her boy, who looked after the pasture, to provide grass for her cow, to provide milk for the cat to keep away the mice that chewed her robes. By this time, she began to notice the villagers avoiding her. They were afraid that she was going to ask them for something more. Even when they saw a brown cow approaching in the distance, thinking it was the nun, they would run away or hide in their houses with the doors securely bolted and the curtains drawn over the windows. When a villager did come to ask her some questions on meditation, she said, "Sorry, not now. I'm too busy. I have to check the hut being built for the boy who looks after my field to graze my cow, that provides the milk for my brown cat that keeps the mice away so that I don't need to keep patching my robes." She noticed what she was saying. She then told the villagers to dismantle the hut, sent the boy back to his family, gave away the cow and the field, and found a good home for her cat. A few days later, she had returned to her simple life with few possessions and dwelling in a cave. After returning one morning from the village with just enough alms food for her one meal of the day, she noticed that a mouse had chewed another hole in her robe. With a quiet smile, she sewed on another patch. We should have it that difficult. Thank you very much.